word in favor of the people who criticized Jesus. I mean, they were making sense. If you put this event in its historic context, understand the people who came to the temple were required to sacrifice animals, dogs, sheep, goats, depending on their material condition and the need in prayer they meant to express, it was required. What could be more logical, even necessary, than to have people at hand in a marketplace to sell the things that were required so that the sacrifice, the worship, could go forward? They were making sense. There needed to be a reasonably convenient, close at hand possibility to purchase the things needed for the sacrifice. Doesn't Jesus seem to be contradicting common sense? He certainly does appear to me to be denying practicality. But of course, that really is precisely the point, isn't it? It is the point that's made by Paul in the second reading. And when he said, in so many words, let's get this straight. The Christ we preach is an absurdity. The Jews will say, we'll know the Messiah has come when he does impressive signs that will persuade everybody, which no one will be able to, you might say, talk away. That's how we'll know. It will appeal to the intelligent, sensible, persuasive powers of ordinary people. And the Greeks will say, we'll know you're telling us the true religion when it's logical, when it is something that will stand up under scholarly criticism. Then we'll know this is the true religion. And Paul says, I got news for you, sisters and brothers. We preach Christ, Lord, but crucified, done in. To the Jews and those who ask for an irrefutable sign, this will be madness. To the Greeks, who are so astute and gifted in the realm of the intellect, it will be nonsense, it will be folly. But we will continue to preach Christ and Him crucified. So it's not all that surprising that Jesus would seem to contradict common sense in this event in the temple place. And it would be a considerable waste of our time to try to critique those details so that they make sense to everybody. As I reflected on these readings, I remembered an event in my own life when I was back in the 50s, an innocent young seminarian. Well, I was a seminarian and I was young in any case. And I made my first visit to Washington and was interested to see a particular thing about which I had heard from my earliest memories, the National Shrine, which was under construction. I say I heard of it because every year in every parish in the United States, the priest put the arm on the people, after having the bishop's arm put on him, to contribute to the annual collection for the building of the National Shrine in honor of Mary, the mother of Jesus, patroness of the United States. Well, I got there before the job was all that much underway. I visited that place when it was still, what else can I call it, but a basement church. The ground floor had not yet even been started. And I tell you truly, this is a fact, that as I remembered that in the immediate time following and through the years, The two things I remember best about that visit to the National Shrine is that they had a very elaborate, large, multifaceted religious goods store in that basement structure. And though I certainly would not have been able to verbalize with the same finesse I might today, the uneasiness I felt there was an uneasiness there. Yet, didn't it make sense? I mean, if every year they had to call on all the Catholics in the United States to put money in the basket so we could build this great shrine to Mary, didn't it make sense to have a religious goods store and bring in some income there too? The other thing I remember about that nascent shrine was a strange section, which I presume is essentially the same to this day. There was a huge hall filled with mammoth columns. And the hall seemed to exist for no reason other than to have a place to put these columns. I suppose they were to be part of the support later when the shrine went up, but at least at that point, these columns were all decorated, festooned, if you will, carved in stone the names of people who had made donations or gifts for the building of the National Shrine. And that bothered me too. I might say as an aside, it has always been a point of relief to me that when I came to this parish, I discovered a place that did not have stained glass windows with the names of people engraved in the bottom of them. Things like that kind of bother me. I mean, after all, it is a faith that should express itself counting on no earthly reward or human recognition, but an act of faith that is its own reward. But now you see what's starting to happen. God save me if there's somebody here whose name or parent's name is inscribed on the bottom of a window and say, you got to watch out. You start getting into things like this. You begin to touch certain sensitivities. But I preach Christ and Him crucified. Folly to Jews and Greeks and all the common sense, practical people of every generation. So I dare tread further, trying to figure this out. And how many people would laugh right in my face if I were to suggest now, especially now that the temple is built and more recently been raised to the status of a basilica, not just a national shrine. Imagine some nut coming along and saying, wouldn't it have been better to plant what would become a giant oak and simply erect a plaque there and say, here is the symbol of Mary, Mother of Jesus, erected by the love and the faith of the people of God of the United States, rooted in the earth, of the earth, earthy, at one with us, but with arms extended to the heavens, reaching beyond the merely human. Now, how could an oak tree ever compare to that magnificent shrine? Of course, I live to see the day when the shrine was completed in the 60s, and it's no secret to tell you lots of people who considered themselves aesthetically sensitive were less than pleased with the final result. That mishmash of architectural styles from a variety of cultures, hard to find any one that is particularly and uniquely American, but one thing's for sure, one glance, you know it cost a fortune. But a lot of people who thought they knew something about art were so disappointed with the final product, I'm not sure it had common parlance among the laity, but certainly among priests and nuns, and in particular those who leaned to the left, there was a kind of irreverent joke that went around, and they said, did you hear some pious woman was visiting the National Shrine, and she had a vision of Mary. And she said, what will you? And Mary said, tell the bishops of the United States, I would like a beautiful shrine built on this site in my honor. to preach the gospel of Jesus Christ is, at the very least, I have become convinced to the depth of my being, at the very least, to tease, to annoy, to disturb, to upset right-thinking people, the wise, the prudent, the well-educated, the sophisticated, the knowledgeable in ours or any society. I'll go so far as to say that in preaching the gospel of Jesus Christ, if you ever got majority applause, maybe you'd better go back to that Bible and reread it and find out what it was you said that was wrong. For the gospel of Jesus will never be the popular plan. It will never be the way embraced easily by the multitudes in all their collective wisdom. I looked at the first reading today and tried to, you might say, view it through this particular prism. And I said to myself, well, there's a simple recounting of the Ten Commandments, the bedrock of the faith of the Hebrews, our mothers and fathers in the desert, the bedrock of their children, the people of God, who we are, the Christian people. The Ten Commandments, sisters and brothers, make sense. They make common sense. I mean, for example, think of them quickly, review them in your mind, and who could deny it? If there is an almighty God, you'd do well to do him worship. And obviously, it would be at the peril of your own soul that you would let other gods or other passions or desires assume a godly place in your life, right? That's good common sense. And only the most immature and silly would ever fail to see the wisdom of reverence and honor for your parents. After all, they are your link with the past, with all their faults and failings. Without them, you are not really in touch with your own history. And even the worst of parents have usually learned a few things by practical experience that you'd do well to learn if you had an open mind and a willingness to grow. That makes good common sense, to honor and respect your parents. And for the rest of it, if for no better reason than your own self-interest, you are wise not to go around killing people, taking their property, messing around with their spouses, their goods, whatever. Because if you had no better reason, you do that to others, they just might do the same to you. And then you'd have chaos if you're going to live in a society with other people. You'd do well to have a sense of individual rights and common respect for the boundaries that must exist among people, lest they tear at each other. So the Ten Commandments make good sense to me. So what's so contradictory about that? Oh. Do not fail to notice the Ten Commandments were, in fact, a common sense foundation, preached, if you will, by God through Moses to what you might call an infantile people in the history of faith, the chosen people at their bare beginnings, who, like children to this day, can take in just so much. But the giving of the Ten Commandments through Moses on that first mountain was but prelude to the words of Jesus on another mountain, the Mount of Beatitudes, when he came saying, not only do not kill, but love your enemies. He came not only saying, you better respect your neighbor's property rights. He said, do good to them that would intrude on your property rights. Overwhelm them with love. Be kind to the cruel and tender to the hard-hearted. And so, assuming that we had somehow grown up somewhat in faith, Jesus came and did not deny or contradict that foundation in the Ten Commandments, but he called us to a higher plane. He challenged us to link ourselves with him and soar beyond the mere realm of the sensible, the practical, the reasonable, to defy even nature itself, to believe that death, our ultimate enemy, can be vanquished, and not usually by might of arms, but by the mighty power of arms extended in love and embrace of enemies. That is contradictory. That is a kind of absurdity. The Jews asked for signs. And we might say spontaneously, he gave them plenty of signs. Did he not go around and heal the crippled, restore sight to the blind? And do not those who walk in the Spirit and the name of Jesus to this day manage to do similar signs? Are not broken people repaired, if you will, and renewed and lifted up? Yes. Yes, there's truth to that, but to the best of my knowledge, never did Jesus put a good eyeball in an empty eye socket. Never. And though the crippled people who have somehow been renewed and stood up straight and walked again seem to be legion in the history of the church, there's not a single account of one missing limb suddenly reappearing. So the sign the Jews would ask for, one that nobody could ever deny, was never given. Why, even the resurrection of Jesus, before the apostles were dead, was being explained away, and to this day, men and women of reason can, if you will, prove to you it is a myth, it is a legend, it never happened. Jesus refused to give the sign that all people would necessarily bow before. And the Greeks demanded wisdom, logic, intelligent, irrefutable explanation of why a people should walk the way of Jesus and bow before the God from whom he had come. And to this day, the number of religions and sects and versions of faith and truth are beyond our counting. Nobody's ever been able to explain the message of Jesus in a way that all right-minded, well-educated, clear-thinking people would say, ha-ha, I am persuaded, I am a Christian. There will always be, with the greatest of the signs of Jesus, after all the most erudite explanations of our religious tradition, there will always be the need for a leap of faith for it to make sense in the way that God's truth alone can make sense in the depth of a person's being. We preach Christ, not triumphant. We preach Christ, not the human, earthly winner, victor. We preach Christ first crucified and only then triumphant. And this message, this reality, must somehow permeate our being, so affect us that it colors the way we hear, interpret, and respond to every and all events of our time. Father Kelly, after many, many years in Africa, preached a homily on these same readings last night, and he pointed out to the people that time and again, when the missionaries went among the beautiful Maasai people in Tanzania and told the story of Jesus, the elders, who were people for whom reverence and respect was an absolute requirement, the elders laughed at the story of Jesus. And with sincerity and respect, they said to the missionaries, how can you say this? How can you tell me he was God but he let them kill him. Why didn't he kill all the false gods? How can you tell us that he was Lord triumphant, but he was humiliated beyond the humiliation of any other person? And those who were preaching the gospel came to know through those who were listening, indeed, this is an absurdity we preach. My sisters and brothers, it is my prayer today that each of you and I and all the people who hear these same readings in whatever chapel or church anywhere get at least this much from the message. When we make Jesus make sense in a world so full of avarice, so at odds even with the Ten Commandments, when we make Jesus sound like he approves of the established order of things, we are probably, I dare say almost certainly, in serious trouble. For me, and I know it is so sensitive a matter to address, when some of us are rejoicing beyond others' comprehension at the good news that children, relatives, friends will be returning from the Gulf whole, and that there is a, as our president put it, a growing air of euphoria in our country. I know it's like raining on the parade to say even the slightest hinting word of sadness and concern. But sisters and brothers, there must be someone somewhere. There must be a people somehow, all but overwhelmed with a sense of mourning for our Iraqi sisters and brothers whose corpses rot now in the desert sand. Someone must be grieving for them with the same kind and quality of grief that we so spontaneously extend to our fellow citizens, sisters and brothers, those relative few who died in the same combat. There must be a people somewhere in the spirit of Jesus for whom euphoria is a luxury that cannot be afforded, who recognize that this is but a pause in the ongoing conflict and tension among peoples. There must be a people somewhere caught up with a passion to see that the Palestinians at long last have a place they can call home. A people who do not use the excuse of the unpopular image of Arafat to dismiss the underlying issues of people in tension and at odds with each other. There must be a people somewhere who, even in this time of national triumph, are all but overwhelmed with the sense of the human tragedy. And I do believe, if there be such a people, we are this people. Why? Because we preach Christ and him crucified. To the Jews, absurdity. To the Greeks, folly. But to us, the might and the power of God.